accession number 19629, reel 2.
Sir Carol Mather, reel 2. You were saying you didn't...
Is that your machine making that noise? Background noise?
I think you were saying you did not know how you were going to get to Finland.
Yes. We never knew, and I don't think the history books have revealed how we were going to get there. But we finally embarked on our ship, our transport, at Glasgow, I think it was, about to sail. But of course, everything was kept practically secret. We weren't told anything at all. And whether we were going to sail through the past Norway and sail on, and what we were going to do, we had no idea. It was, you see, it was winter. It was the middle of winter. And the research I've done on it, there's been no clues at all.
You were saying that, and you said in the book that there was a great deal of enthusiasm and amateurism at that time in the army, and that the army didn't become professional in its approach for a long time.
Right.
But when did the army become professional, do you think? How long did it take?
Well, the turning point of everything was Alamein. And I would date it from that time. Of course, the regiments fighting out in the desert were very professional. But the leadership really wasn't as good as it might have been.
What's needed to be improved about the leadership?
Well, I think we better come to this when we talk about the Desert War, because this is where it... But in the early days of the leadership, everything was pretty chaotic. Balls up. Everything was balls up, it was said. And in the Ski Battalion, our professional officers, who were a lot of them were regular Scots Guardsmen, were very professional. The organisation was not very professional, really. And it seems a mad idea, really, that you should put into a battalion a mass of officers. Mm-hmm. Most of them were pre-war soldiers. And embark on a campaign in possible territory in the middle of winter with very little training. I mean, we got no wirelesses. The only weapon we had was the rifle. And as it was later discovered, large number of people who had actually joined on rather false pretenses had never fired a service rifle in their lives. There were no cooking arrangements. None of the officers knew how to cook. It was all put together in a great hurry. We had a very fine commanding officer, Jimmy Coates, and some very good officers. It was a kind of panic move. Mm-hmm. And of course, if we had become engaged with the Russians, it would become a disaster for later stages in the war. Very ill thought out. Rather like Mr. Blair today.
There hasn't yet been an appeal for mountaineers to volunteer, though, has there?
The what?
There hasn't yet been an appeal for mountaineers to volunteer for Kosovo.
Not yet, unfortunately.
I think after the Scots Guards, 5th Scots Guards, you went to the Welsh Guards.
Yes, I was down. I mean, at Sandhurst, I was down for the Welsh Guards.
How was that regiment chosen? How did you choose it, or were you chosen by them?
A group of us at Cambridge, there were one or two who were doing a supplementary reserve. These are Upper Cambridge, were doing a supplementary reserve attachment in the summer, as indeed I had engaged to do myself with the Welsh Guards, simply because I had a group of chums who were doing the same thing. In the end, I didn't do the attachment because I had an opportunity to go off to America. And then, beginning of the war, someone tried to persuade me to join the Royals. And there was a long waiting list for that regiment. So I then reapplied to Welsh Guards before I went to Sandhurst.
The Royals, that'd be the Royal Dragoons?
Royal Dragoons, yeah. So I applied to Welsh Guards before going to Sandhurst, and I got put on the books.
When you joined them at Colchester, what were they actually doing? What training were they doing?
Drill on the square. The officer, the young officers, our time was taken up entirely with turnout, drill on the square, in service dress. I think we started off with boots and putties, and then we wore service dress trousers. Turnout was the very important part of the proceedings, and the adjutant used to come along and inspect the officers, and if he found someone with a dirty belt or dirty buttons, he'd say, "Put your servant in the book." Or Richie's servant had to go in the book, and he probably got an extra drill for his troubles. We didn't do any tactical training there. Except when the invasion scare came. This was immediately after the evacuation of Dunkirk, which we played a small part in because we officers were sent to form a reception committee for the parts of BAF came back to Harwich.
You mentioned that this had a great impact on you, seeing the BAF coming back. What were your thoughts upon
them? They were in such disarray. Mm. They were obviously dirty and disheveled, and some had their weapons, some didn't. I mean, it was a defeated army.
At any time, did you feel that it might be possible we would lose the war? Did you have any apprehension of a general defeat?
Oh, yes. Really, until after the Battle of Alamein, it was touch and go as to whether we actually would lose the war or not. Because the Germans and the Italians were really much better prepared than we were. The Italians had been, campaigning in Abyssinia. So they'd had recent military experience. The Germans were fully equipped with the latest type of equipment and the latest methods such as the parachute drops and all that kind of thing, which we hadn't thought of at all. So really from Dunkirk onwards it was touch and go until after the Battle of Alamein. Of course, disaster followed disaster. Europe, Greece, Crete, Singapore, one of the major turning points, of course, was actually when the Germans attacked Russia. So Russia was brought into the war. So that was a turning point, obviously.
Another important thing, of course, was the arrival of the United States, their entry to the war.
Yeah.
Which of the two events do you think had the greatest effect on you at the time?
I think the Russians had the biggest impact on us, because we really, on our uppers then, this was in June 1941. We were alone, you see, no one was with us. So this was the first time that we had a major ally joining in the fight. The American help came very slowly. They were helping with equipment in the latter stages of the Desert War, and also before Alamein, where we got actually 1941, we were getting honey tanks, and then the Shermans came along before the Battle of Alamein, and the Jeeps came along, and so we were getting a lot of equipment then from from America, and American observers came out to see how things were going. But we didn't feel any real impact until after Pearl Harbor. Mm. And I think I point out in my book that American tank production about this time, 1941, was virtually nil. I mean, they produced something like 17 tanks in the whole of the United States.
Mm. Were there any really serious invasion scares after Dunkirk? Serious invasion scares. Were there any alarms?
Yes. I mean, to go back to Kolchatka, we had a very serious invasion scare when we were there. Mm. And we then started digging defences in the coastal area. And we were really completely unequipped. We had no wireless sets. We only had rifles, and and we lay out in positions, you know, near the coast, armed with rifles, nothing else.
What about parachute assaults? Were there any scares about that?
Oh yes, yeah, there were. Germans dressed as nuns was the great one. Yeah.
Did you ever see a German dress as a nun?
No. Only your dad's army, I think.
Having served in the Scots Guards and then moved to the Welsh Guards, was there any significant difference between the two regiments?
Only minor differences. I always remember that the daily orders, the company commander's orders, which we call memorandum, the Scots Guards always marched in at the salute and halted and then put their hand up. We never did that. They marched in, then saluted. There's funny little differences like that, actually. But it was all the brigade guards, and so the training and everything was the same.
Where did your soldiers come from? Were your soldiers Welshmen, or were they from all over the country?
The vast majority were Welshmen. And they came from the valleys. They came from all over Wales. A lot from the valleys.
How did they receive you when you first arrived as a platoon commander?
Well, you see, the officer was a different being from them in those days. And they accepted this as someone who almost spoke a different language. And so they would, you know, automatically accept. We were very young, of course. They'd automatically accept young officers, because the young officers had more savoir-faire than they did. Yeah. And also, the thing that struck one at the time was that many of these lads had never left home. And we'd been to boarding schools and public schools, and you know, we'd actually knocked about and roughed it, in a way, more than they had.
How long did it take you to get to know them?
Oh, very short time, really. Of course, one didn't have at the training battalion at Colchester, we didn't have a platoon. Oh. We were in an officer's squad.
Yes.
And so, then we moved. After Dunkirk, we moved to Sandown Park, and we then were organised on a company basis, and no difficulty in getting to know the men at all.
What persuaded you to volunteer for the commandos?
Well, after Dunkirk, it was fairly obvious that we were going to be stuck in England for a long time. And I found the life at a training battalion rather irksome and petty. And so I left the opportunity to join a commando. We didn't know what a commando was, really, in those days. But it was thought that they had something to do with raiding the French coast.
So was there, to a certain extent, it was a leap into the dark?
Well, it was obviously going to be a more active form of soldiering. And it was a it was a special services, and it was obviously more attractive than sitting in on a training battalion.
Was the regiment happy to let you volunteer and go off?
Yes, because I'd well, lost my name on several occasions, and they were probably rather relieved, I think.
What sort of training did the commandos give you?
I see that. Should we just pull that? Oh, no, not that. We invented our own training. First thing, I, as I point out in my book, we had, we didn't have enough Welsh Guardsmen to form a, what we called a troop, which was the same as a company. and we had too many officers, so I was sent to the Scots Guards troop. And we invented it as we went along. We knew we were raiding forces, and we had to adopt entirely different tactics and methods of training to what we'd already learnt. And we never moved in form bodies. That was the first. That was the first lesson which we learned. The men never lived in barracks. They were all billeted out, wherever we happened to be. We were boating, hill climbing. And particularly when we later on we got Scotland, we were doing exercise, landing exercise and that kind of thing. And we were using totally different tactics, you know, the kind of tactics of a cat burglar rather than the soldier.
Stealth.
Right?
Using stealth.
Stealth, and yeah. And so this was all rather invigorating, really.
Who taught you these skills? Amphibious landing is a rather specialised art, isn't it? Who did you borrow?
We just learned as we went along.
You didn't borrow from the Royal Marines to learn about that?
Royal Marines really weren't doing landing exercise in those days.
How did you get the soldiers into the commando? Were they volunteers or were they sent?
They were volunteers. most of them... well, in the commando, number 8 commando, we had a troop from each of the Hussar cavalry regiments. And then we had a cavalry line, we had a marine troop, and we had, I think, an infantry of the line, and the sappers. And... we just invented it as we went along. I'd been, you know, doing quite a lot of exploring and things like that before the war. And I knew, you know, about crossing country and river crossings and, you know, all sorts of things like that. And I'd been a Boy Scout. I knew about woodcraft and tying knots and all the kind of useful things and living off the country, that kind of thing.
Did you find that the men from one part of the army adapted more rapidly to this informal way of carrying on than from other parts of the army?
No, I don't think there was any particular part of our lot who were more skilled in these things or took it more readily. Of course, the sappers were very useful with their knowledge of explosives and bridge building and things of that sort. but everyone took to it like ducks to water, really. Although the training of guardsmen had been totally opposite to what we were then trying to do.
Must have required a change of mind on their part.
Yes, oh, it did. Yes, it was a great adventure for them. They loved it, of course.
What style of discipline did you have in the commando?
We needed hardly any discipline, really, because if there were any serious misdemeanors, they were simply sent back to their units. Mm. And they knew this. And so there was hardly necessary to impose discipline at all.
How much warning did you have that you were going to be sent abroad?
Well, we were training up in Scotland. We were training from the island of Arran for a landing operation. And by this time, we were on a specially adapted commando ship with LSTs, I think they were called. No, landing ship infantry, LSIs would they be. which we had hanging from the davits. And we were landing on an island, a rocky island, and but we had no idea where it was. And when we set sail, we still had no idea where we were going. It was all very hush-hush those days. when we got to the canal zone, we were again training on some low hillocks there for a landing. Still didn't know where. I think it was going to be either Pantelleria or Rhodes. very shortly after we landed, various disasters took place. The evacuation of Greece and then Crete. The Navy had lost an awful lot of ships in the Mediterranean. And therefore their capacity to embark on commando landing operations was very limited. In fact, they really, they had to opt out in the air because there weren't enough ships. And so, hence, after a very short life out there, the commando brigade, as it was disbanded.
You mentioned that there was a considerable amount of indiscipline in the commando brigade and some bizarre incidents. What sort of things were going on?
Amongst the men was very little indiscipline. A lot of the officers were rather wild. but there was, I mean, morale definitely suffered when we were left kept in a continual state of inaction and not really knowing what we were going to do.
What were your impressions of Egypt when you first arrived?
We arrived wearing woolsey tepis. We basically gave those up, and we were based in the canal zone to begin with, and that was a pretty godforsaken spot, really. Occasionally, you used to get up to Cairo, but it was getting a bit hot then. It was April, I suppose, sometime like that, and we really weren't told what we were going to do. We did these exercises, but nothing seemed to come of it. And then, of course, one was conscious of these disasters happening, Greece and Crete. And so we knew that, obviously, the plans had gone awry in some way. But we went, the only action which we did was, we did this raid in the gunboat, the HMS Aphis. and we were more or less bombed out of existence in that. And then... the brother officer in the Coldstream Troop, George Jericho and I, had the idea. We were sitting doing nothing outside Alexandra, of making our way to Tobruk, of equipping ourselves from the commando stores with ammunition and explosives. We told our superiors vaguely what we were going to do. There was no difficulty about this. And we hitched a lift on a destroyer to Tobruk, and we then put up this plan to the garrison commander, who was Morshead, the Australian Morshead, to carry out this raid on Gazala, which had been the target of the commando expedition on HMS Aphis. We knew that on the land, we had the air photographs, we knew what the targets were, and we thought we could achieve just as much with two of us as we could with landing 100 men. And the Navy provided some what we call Eureka light craft, or one of them, and a driver, a navigator, an officer was in command of this ship, and the Navy, like everyone else in those days, was very amateur. He wasn't awfully good at navigation. And after several attempts, we never made a landfall. And so the idea had to be abandoned. But the interesting thing was, being in Tobruk for about 6 or 7 weeks during the height of the siege, which was quite an experience.
What did General Morshead say when you first appeared in front of him with your plan?
What did he say?
Yeah.
He said, very good idea. This was the, really the headquarters, the town headquarters for the siege of Tobruk. Gazala, and there was an airfield there, and there was headquarter buildings, and we knew the layout, and we were going to lay bombs or whatever. We were then going to, getting back was the least planned part of the operation. The light craft wasn't going to wait for us. We were going to make our way back through the lines, and starting at the German end. And to prepare for this, we'd stayed for a week with the 18th Indian Cavalry Regiment, which was manning the perimeter on foot. And we went out with them on long patrols into no man's land to learn where the various salient points were. Whether there were any minefields, I'm not quite sure, but in those days there were no anti-personnel mines. They were all anti-tank mines, so you could walk over them with safety.
So you're planning to come back on foot,
just on foot.
Exfiltration?
At night, yeah.
What do you think your chances would have been?
Getting back?
Yeah.
Pretty small, really.
Did you have any sense of priorities about what targets you were going to attack first when you got to Gazala?
Yes, we knew there were certain key points. We knew what the buildings were used for. There were some aircraft stationed there. So we knew what we were going to do. Yeah.
Were you going to give priority to the headquarters or to the aircraft?
I think the headquarters, actually. Mm-hmm.
You were saying in your book that some of the exercises in the canal zones were laborious and not very professional. What was wrong about them, about the way things were done?
Well, we were just inventing things as we went along. Oh. To simulate a landing operation, we put a huge, long bit of white tape around a feature, a hillock or whatever, and that was the seashore. And then we would make our way up to gain the heights. And we do long route marches too in the desert. And we were pretty fit, actually.
Mm-hmm. Now you mentioned that you could occasionally